right. Lighting.
Lighting. Camera. Lights, camera.
Cup of tea.
Smaction.
Smaction. Gin and tonic.
Gin and tonic. What time is it for you?
18:36. Yeah, so evening. It's dark out here. It's winter in Bali. If you could ever imagine there was such a thing.
Really?
Yeah, blustery winds. And we had, so they fly kites at this time of year, which is really beautiful, right? And they make all their kites with, I guess, plastic that they just find wherever they go. I don't know if there's a shop for this, but so everyone's got a real kite that they put some real heart and effort into in their house. So there's like birds and butterflies in the sky, and it's really sweet. Like, it's actually a spectacle because everyone's got their own kite that they made out of discarded plastic.
The
or whatever.
Family kite.
Yeah. Or like all the brothers and all the sisters have a different kind of kite, and they're all like flying in the sky and racing. And just where we stay, if you look out, we've got a river in front of us. And then over on the other side, all the kites are flying. And just before I came in to record this with you, there was the neighbor across the stream. It's basically got a kite the shape of a giant penis. And he's flying it so proudly in front of the house like this. I was like, wow. Adele was on my phone at the time. I couldn't record it, but it was like there's a giant
phallus.
Lingam, like they call it. Yeah, a giant phallus flying in the air outside of the sky.
That's
and of course,
great.
Like I'm talking with friends today about debates of masculinity, and you can't have the phallus erect in public anymore. And there it was in front of our garden.
And imagine how in the culture of India and various cultures, the history of it, carved into stone was the phallus and the, you know, and now it's like taboo because of our Victorian influence, you know, in the West for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the symbol of worship, the lingam statue, and then there's the lingam, and then there's the yoni, and it. Yeah, I mean, in India, it's incredible. They have this whole holy site, Khajuraho.
Yeah,
I think it's said like that, and that's the one where you've got the tantric orgies all over the temples, and it's like probably the only iconic one remaining in the country where you can go and get the. Oh wow, these are the people that did the Kama Sutra, you know, back in the days where it was inscribed. And it's right at the top of the tourist list.
And so. You've been there, right? I've not been.
I've not been to that site, but I've been to plenty of different holy places of worship around the south of India. So this is Goa, Kerala, Tamil Nadu. Yeah, sacred mountains and sacred temples, and yeah, lots of lingam statues. Mm. That's for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, welcome to episode number 4.
Welcome.
You're right.
I'm ready. Got my tea.
Welcome back. Yeah. Tea check, lights, camera, action. There's a few topics I wanted to bring up today. There's stuff that I've been fascinated by on my own. Still coming up to the end of lockdown. So it's been an intellectual time more than an exploring time in the outside world. But
right.
A lot of stuff that I wanted to chat with you about beauty, about cultural collapse and demise and disintegration, the beauty, the one of the things we were talking about just before we hit record was about beauty philosophy and these philosophers of beauty, and of course your teacher and mentor Sir Roger Scruton, who passed away but left a big body of work on the philosophy of beauty. And we recently discovered, like within the last day, that there's other people out there having the same conversation as us, or attempting to.
What's interesting is the link you sent me has this phraseology, saving beauty, right? Saving beauty. Like the Ars Amrata for us, like, you know, our subtitle of Ars Amrata is restoring beauty, right? Restoring beauty.
Yeah.
And I thought about that, about saving beauty. And my thesis is this: beauty doesn't need saving. We need saving. We're the ones that are lost. Beauty is not lost. Beauty is a constant. It's a constant, like the number E, like the number pi. It's a constant it's a thrum. It's a thrumming energy at the bottom of the universal. It's a universal constant, just like anything else is. And beauty is there, whether we look at it or not, whether we participate in it or not. And the idea that beauty needs to be saved, no. Beauty is eternal and divine, yeah. Right? And we're the ones that are lost. We're the ones that, like, that turned our face away from beauty. We're the ones that said, no, ugliness is supreme and antagonism is supreme. And so the concept of, or the phrase of saving beauty, no, I don't think so. Beauty doesn't need saving. We need saving.
So does that mean then that beauty is ever present and eternal, even if there is no witness?
Yes. Yes. Beauty needs a witness to become manifest in our hearts. That's the phrase I use, right? To become evident, to make us stand on this earth with purpose and dignity and kindness and empathy. Beauty needs that witness, okay? But beauty is there, no matter if we look at it or not. It's us that are failing. It's not beauty that's failing. Beauty isn't faltering. Beauty isn't falling away. Beauty isn't an old, antiquated idea or concept. Even though the art world today would say that beauty is like disenfranchised, or beauty is
or dead. That'd probably say something a lot more
dead. Yeah, beauty is dead. Yeah. It's like God is dead, like Nietzschean, right? And they say beauty is dead and beauty serves no purpose, and they're wrong. The modern avant-garde, you know, type of art establishment, I guess you could say, artistic establishment, is all about shock and shock and awe. Yeah. But beauty is supreme. Beauty trumps all. Beauty is there no matter what you try and degrade it down into the dirt. And you can't, yeah, because beauty is supreme over top of you, you know? Incredible.
Right. It's interesting. I'm laughing on the inside because it's like, well, if beauty exists without a witness, it sounds like you're saying if human consciousness were turned off, either because of some mass ignorance or some, yeah, you know, extinction event, and we're gone and the dolphins are gone and all sentient beings are gone, beauty would continue to throb, yeah, and to thrive and to be in this universe.
Yeah, I really think, Jordan, that beauty, the more I contemplate it, and the more I study, and the more I read, and the more I sit scratching my cheek like this, the more I do these things, the more I really believe that beauty is a fundamental. It is a tangible, real element, just like quarks are a real element, or molecules are real. Beauty is a real, solid, pure element of the beginning of the universe till now. You know, we hear, you know, you hear about the noise of the universe, like the white noise of the universe. You know, there's a pulse of energy that
God's
comes.
God's word or the Om, yeah, mantra. The,
yeah, yeah, all these things. And I believe that beauty, you know, dark matter and all these things we're just now intuiting. The incredible concept that I've been contemplating on lately is this. This is on the topic, but maybe off the topic, but it's interesting. This concept of intuitionist mathematics that is intuitional. In other words, imagine this. Let's say that there's evolution a Big Bang happened, and we evolved from the primordial soup. Okay, or God created, or a prime mover created the universe, and we move forward to this modern society we have today. Okay, so either one, there's a trajectory. And what this, but imagine this: at some point in the history of mankind, someone first thought of the concept of the number 1 million. If you're primitive in a cave, you have, you know, one stick, two wives, three bears outside that are trying to destroy you. So you can say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are very practical numbers, right? But yeah, the number 1 million, let alone 1 billion, let alone 1 trillion. Your camera jumped.
I'm here.
Okay. Yeah. And any of these concepts are abstract. So to a caveman, 1 trillion is something he's never encountered. He's never considered. He's never thought about it. He's never enjoined that thought at all. Okay? Mm. There you go. You're so back smiling and pretty.
In high definition once more. Intuitional mathematics. And that's talking about the way that somebody could, a conscious being for the first time, could conceive of this thing and then give it a name and create that classification as a kind of construct, a structure in the mind of thought.
Imagine
that
this
is then able to
it becomes
manage.
Real. Like imagine this. We have this dichotomy, this ancient conversation between free will and determinism, right? If we knew the initial state of the universe, then all the molecules that banged around like pool billiard balls, right? We would know that your choice to live in Bali, to go and like eat that soup or whatever you did today, was not a choice by you, but by predetermined by the molecules that, you know, banged off each other. That's determinism. And the opposite is free will, which is very, you know, all religions think there's free will, which is you have the choice. And to, you know, so there's this, always been this dichotomy, this battle between these two dualities. And the great thing is, amazingly, is this: the intuitionist mathematics is saying, until someone conceptualized the concept of 1 million, it didn't exist. Mm. Just like until somebody observes that particle, it has no defined state. It's in an indeterminate state until it's defined. So imagine if you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, those are all real, everybody can get it. But if you go all the way up to 1 million, how many people on this earth have ever observed entirety, 1 trillion of anything? Right? Think about it. Like, here's a concept which is amazing, which is, if you know, is there more grains of sand on the earth, including all the beaches, than there are heavenly bodies? And no, because on the grains of sand, there's something like, they estimate there's something septillion, whatever, which is like incredibly large number.
Too big for your conception, the power of conception.
I can't even think it. But of the heavenly bodies, you know, which we can, if you look at the sky, you see maybe 1,000 stars from horizon to horizon. You see about 1,000. Yeah. But if you go to the Hubble telescope and you go to, and then you extrapolate from the little tiny, you know, then you've got 1 million times of stars, which is more than the sands on the entire earth, grains of sand on the entire earth.
Wow.
And then if you go further, the great concept, I can't remember the guy who said it, but it's a great concept. In 10 drops of water, normal drops, bloop, 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 there is as many molecules in those 10 drops of water as all those heavenly bodies. So the idea is like, so the idea that 1 million or 1 billion or 1 trillion is a finite number, or I guess what I'm trying to say is, if a caveman conceptualized the idea of trillion, it's abstract. He has never seen a trillion of anything, right? But it's abstract, when the first humanoid or human or man thought of the concept of 1 trillion, it now became real. It was materialized, just like in the quantum theory. It now became real. So the idea of this expanding universe, which we have, right, is expanding because of more information is becoming be created, not known, but being created. So space and time, according to Einstein's block theory of the universe, contains a certain amount of information. Information has volume. And so for the universe to expand, information expands. And so as we learn more about beauty, about these things, like look at modern technology and the modern age, we're on, like we feel, you and I talk, we have these episodes, we feel like we're on the cusp of being included in the knowledge that is being created that was never there 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, because the universe is expanding and information is expanding. The universe is expanding because the information is expanding. I don't know. Incredible. It's exciting.
So you got to this through beauty.
Because my thesis...
I just wanted to say one little thing. It's interesting studying the Tao Te Ching as we were before. The Chinese would call all of the heavenly beings and all of the grains of sand, they would call the 10,000 things. So at that point in history, it seems like they'd only been able to conceive
10,000.
Until 10,000. Right.
Exactly.
Then.
Great point.
Yeah.
So a million did not exist until somebody conceptualized it.
Quite a bit later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a concept that's, you know, there's two schools of thought. There's the mathematicians that think that numbers are whole and complete and finite, and we observe them and we learn more about them. And there's the intuitionists who believe that numbers are like the concept of a million, which didn't exist 1,000 years ago, Jordan. It didn't exist. Like 10,000, right? It was 10,000 grains of sand.
Yeah.
Right? So when somebody came up with a million, these intuitionists, and this is the battle for the last 100 years between the mathematicians, is that the intuition is saying that no, when we conceptualize a million, it became real. It didn't exist before then. Incredible. Comes out of our consciousness or mind. So my relation to this of beauty is beauty is a conceptual entity, but it is 100% real, just like the ancients called the ether is real, just like we call atomic energy as real, you know, the weak force and the strong force of nuclear energy. It's as real as that. Beauty is a constant vibration at the base of our consciousness. And the other thing, you asked me before the call, what have you been thinking about lately? I said, nothing. But I've been thinking about a lot lately, actually. The other thing that is incredible is that there's this beauty hum energy underneath that underpins everything. You know? I was going to say something, I forgot it. It'll come back to me. Incredible.
So in terms of human consciousness, if beauty exists and has always existed, it's this kind of subparticular vibration or hum that is all about in the cosmos, to whatever degree and variants. I guess we don't know. That's another rabbit hole. But humanity, our collective ability to perceive and know that beauty seems to be in and out in a really interesting way. In that,
yeah,
collectively, if you're having this conversation and there are other minds awakening to this kind of conversation around the world, it's like you could say that humanity is on the cusp of discovering this hum in a deeper way, and maybe science will come and back you up, you know, in a few decades when it gets around to it. You might be backed up and have your philosophies vindicated. Beauty is real, you know, front page headlines. but it seems like right throughout history, like spanning at least probably a couple of thousand years, there have been certain individuals or maybe even pockets of culture who would have related or conceived of beauty in a similar way.
No question. No question. Like, we're not saying anything new, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, you know? So it's like, but every generation forgets what they learned from the generations before. And so it's like up to a few voices to speak that again, just to open that dialogue, that dialectic up again, you know? So yeah, I really do believe, and more I'm thinking this, I'm reading about mathematicians, and I'm reading about physicists, and I'm reading about philosophers, and reading about poets, and reading these things, and more, and like Einstein, Kandinsky, you know, Kandinsky basically invented abstraction in painting, you know, like, and then Stravinsky in music. Stravinsky's like altered the course of music. And I'm reading about this kind of, these kind of conceptualized Freud and Jung and stuff, yeah, right? They came up with these concepts that were prevalent in the ether, quote unquote, the ether. They were already there in the heavens. So as you and I are articulating these types of concepts and trying to understand this, it's vibrating across the static energy of the stratosphere of the Earth, and other people are tuned into it and getting electric shocks in the same concepts that we are. You know, it's not just us. It's a collective that's happening, a collective understanding. That's why Tesla and Einstein, or Tesla and Edison, both conceptualized and fought for electricity in their own different, because electricity was, its time was come to be born on the Earth.
Yeah.
You know? And flight, same thing with the Wright brothers and the others around that time, or the combustion engine. You know, all these things were like fruitful and being born at the same time because the knowledge of the Earth collectively, of the people of the Earth, and the all kind of like coalescing to this, wait a minute, if this is that, then this is that, and wait a minute, we can make a battery? And so batteries are invented in different parts of the world at the same time, right? So because the consciousness of mankind is ready for it. And there's a great theory, which is, I don't know if it's true or not, but 3,000 years ago, they could never conceptualize about something that we're talking about now, because the mind of the humans was not developed enough to understand it. If you went back 3,000 years ago and you tried to explain the iPhone to them, they could not conceptualize anything you're talking about because their minds couldn't grasp the complexity of it. Their minds are too simple for it. Like more reptilian or more, you know, incredible.
Even Da Vinci.
Even Da Vinci.
Had him an iPhone 500 years ago.
Even Da Vinci would be flummoxed by an iPhone and say, no, I don't, you could not explain it to him in a way that he would understand.
I've got a new, like, next time we're at a dinner party and someone's like, if you could go back in time and have a dinner with anyone living or dead, where would you go? I'd say, I'm going to Da Vinci with an iPhone and see if he can make head nor tail of this object.
Well, Da Vinci's a time traveler, man. He has to be, because he came back from the future because the concepts he said, nobody even remotely considered. And he was coming up with concepts, you know?
Yeah. I'd love to say, you know, I haven't done as much reading around this topic as I would like to, but I love the concept of in the noosphere, in this kind of realm of thoughts and ideas, which is kind of on the cusp of what is a thought and what is not yet manifest. It's like the density of these vibrations that are going to be ideas, or they're trying to land as ideas, but they lay just outside of consciousness, but they're crossing through in dreams and in, you know, in the shower and all kinds of places. If some people are picking up on certain electric shocks.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how somehow a certain evolution happens. It's fascinating to me, like, what is that field? Where and how does it work that these ideas come through certain people to a massive degree, but massive part of humanity is numb to this kind of divine inspiration? And there's all kinds of wonderful concepts, like the evolution of memes, for example, and there's this thing, this kind of dark art notion of the egregores, which someone can cast a mystical psychic spell, throw it out to the world to create a collective, like to actually create these thought forms that then land in human consciousness.
Like a meme.
Weave a magical, a collective curse or a collective meme, weave it together, stick it out to the universe. Like the idea of fascism or Marxism.
Yeah.
These are penned by somebody, but even before the words hit the paper and it hits the printing press and it goes out to so many people, that these concepts are in the air, kind of like a coronavirus. A person gets it And then they sneeze on a few close friends and they all get it. And then they move out to the world and the message disseminates. And before you know it, there's 8 million people that are infected with the fascism virus or the Marxism virus. And it grows from there. Like the thought form starts to go and have its own critical mass and spread of its own accord.
Yeah. And you couldn't take that sneezing concept of Marxism or fascism or whatever and sneeze it onto a caveman, right? Because they couldn't, there's no receptors for that. They couldn't conceptualize it. It would be like a foreign language, or maybe Da Vinci, you know, if you took these concepts of the modern ideology today and you took it back in, you know, 500 years ago, would they have the ability to conceptualize or to absorb that information and add it to their worldview? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Let's bring some of these different loops and rabbit holes back to the core purpose, the core of this conversation here, which is beauty and restoring beauty. Damn, there's a lot of different directions. So saving beauty is one way of looking at things. And you're saying beauty doesn't need to be saved. It's us that needs to be saved. In fact, beauty is quite all right, hovering below in its own kind of subatomic place in the universe. But it's us that somehow need to be saved. So restoring beauty...
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, the way I interpreted those different words is that saving beauty is almost like beauty is almost dead. It's almost going. We have to do some superhuman effort to keep
Heimlich maneuver. Yeah.
But then restoring beauty, if I just take those, I'm taking these words totally on face value here and what it just does to me as a listener.
Yeah.
But restoring beauty is like, it sounds like beauty is already dead and you have to do something to rekindle it. Like,
maybe that's the wrong word too. Mm. Yeah, because really what it is, Jordan, it's not saving it. It's rediscovering it, I guess you could say. Because it's not gone away. Beauty is there. Beauty is the impulse. Beauty is the call, you know? And we are the ones who have stopped responding to that call. It's like the Holy Spirit calling our hearts, or God calling our hearts, or poeticism, you know, poesy calling our hearts. And we hear the call of poetics, the call of the, and we reject it. It's rejected from us, which is incredible. We're saying that's not practical. It's not rational. It doesn't serve me to eat and sleep and keep a coherent life, you know? Like we talk about essential services in this lockdown. Essential services, what is essential, you know? And essentialism, one of the essential things is beauty and poetics, you know, art. We can't exist without art. It's like if all the women were erased from the earth right now, and right at the moment I said that, would you have any reason to exist? Would you be like, well, and what? Like live in Waterworld and like Mad Max, and there's no reason to exist. If all the women are gone from the earth, I would want to cease to exist. And if all the art is gone from the earth, which is equivalent in my mind, I would want to cease to exist. You know, it's an essential thing like water and food and air, you know?
Yeah.
It's essential. Yeah. And beauty is that underpinning, that concept that underpins it all. Beauty is art, you know?
Yeah.
Including the dark side of beauty, which is sadness, contemplation, looking out the window, and wistfulness, you know? All these things are components of beauty.
Horror, to add to that list.
Horror.
Yeah. There can be a strange beauty in horror.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Horror.
Or in decrepitude, there can be a strange beauty in decrepitude, which is like something that is broken and something is falling apart, something that's in disrepair. Like Joseph Brodsky said this, I forgot what he said, but it's something like this. He said, there's nothing more beautiful than the sight of ruins. That's what he said. There's nothing more beautiful than the sight of ruins. To me, that's 100% accurate. If I see ruins, Roman ruins, I'm in Romania and I see Roman ruins, or I go to England and I see ruins of something, or I go to Croatia, and every hill in Croatia, and if you drive around the countryside, in every hill there's a castle. Like, I mean a castle with a moat and a castle with a drawbridge that's in disrepair and just, stone upon stone and it's ruins. And there's nothing, it's forest around it, like overgrown with trees, and there's nothing more beautiful than the sight of ruins, you know? Mm.
Good catch, by the way. You know, we were talking about beauty philosophers having a poor memory for quotes. You pulled that one back.
I hear a lot of quotes, but I can never remember who said it. I'm like, was that Jordan that said that? Maybe I'll from that one, I'm going to attribute all the quotes I don't know to Jordan Luke Collier. Hey.
So I like the sound of that. I logged on to one of your calls on the Essentials course just a few weeks ago, and it's funny that the Chinese whispers. When someone tells a story, that tells the story to the next person, and as the story goes round and round the community, it kind of grows and morphs and distorts. Yeah, I heard amazing stories about my travels that I never knew that I did. Like,
well, I embellish everything. You know, the great thing about a storyteller...
I'm turning into a Goliath, you know, the way that you present me is cool.
The great thing about a storyteller is the great storytellers are the ones who exaggerate everything. Everything has to be exaggerated and larger than life. And you're going to love this. You're going to love the story, Jordan. And then I did, you know, it has to be exaggerated. It's not lying. No, because lying is deceiving. This is more like enlarging, embiggening right. in the word of the Simpsons. We're embiggening life, you know? So I always do that. I always exaggerate and make things bigger and like, oh, you're going to... Because it's fun. And it's part of the storytelling ethos, you know? It's part of this... Part of the reason you're telling a story is to have this like sneaking magnificent boom. Incredible.
Yeah. I still want to flesh out a couple of more things on this restoring beauty thread. And we talked about how an idea can spread like a virus.
Right.
We talked about how this hum of beauty is there, whether we are awake to perceive it or not, or whether we're paying attention to it or we're distracted, or whether some authoritarian government has come in and tried to domesticate that hum of beauty so that we just get conditioned fully out of ever having a chance to see it until one day it kind of always pops through like a weed through a daisy through a concrete slab. It will pop through into the psyche. I think even in the most authoritarian shutdown society. It's my belief.
I'm listening.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you a question. It looked like you were going off on another thread. But in terms of purpose and motivation, which is where we were at on the last show, if restoring beauty is the working subtitle of our efforts in the world, what does that actually look like, both on an individual scale, like this man or this woman, like they've got it, they're doing it, like they're a full embodiment of the aspiration that I have when I do my writing or I do my talks. How do you know when restoring beauty is being successful on an individual level? How will you know whether on a collective level these aspirations are actually coming through and having some kind of regenerative impact on the psyches, minds, hearts.
Well, let me elucidate a little bit about what we're talking about here when we talk about the concept of restoring beauty, because it would be hubris for us to assume that we have, that we are the authority to restore beauty. Like, in other words, we're going to restore beauty. Like you said earlier, that the concept of restoring beauty may have a connotation that beauty is faltering or is on its last legs, right? Mm. And we need to restore it to its place. But the problem is, the shift of perspective of that is that beauty is constant. It's a constant thrum. It's a constant hum at the bottom of the universe. So what the concept of restoring beauty is basically, we're restoring it to our consciousness, to our hearts. We're restoring it in us. We're retrieving it back into our collective thinking, back into our conceptual ideas of politics, relationships. We're rejuvenating it back, or pulling it back into what we think, as opposed to something that beauty needs us to restore it, if that makes sense. It doesn't need us at all. Beauty is consistent. We're going to live and die. We're going to be dead. In 50 years, we're going to be dead. In 50 years, I'm going to be dead. And beauty never changed. Beauty's sitting there constantly looking forth across everything, like a horizon, you know?
So it's important distinction, because it's like we do, I think, as humans, believe that we are the rulers of the universe. And so if we set out on a 10-point agenda to restore beauty somehow into culture, that we could do it, and without us it won't happen.
That's right.
But so beauty is much more sublime and godly and omnipotent than we are.
It's more omnipotent
species.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a, I'm hearing like a reverence, like, you know, I don't have power over you, but I could have power over me to let more of you in.
Right. It's us. It's restoring beauty into us, as opposed to restoring beauty as like it needs to, we need to, you know, paste over it and change the patina and paint a few cracks on it and fix it. We don't have to fix beauty. If we need to restore it into us, so that when we stand on this earth, you know, with in Bali or Romania, wherever we are, we're standing on this earth with beauty infused through us like a infusion. You know, so the idea that, so I want to make that strong distinction that beauty is unclamored. It is untouched. It is untrammeled. Okay. We didn't trod on beauty and destroy it. No, that's hubris. That's us saying we're greater than beauty and we're not. So beauty is there, and it is a constant layer of vibration beneath everything. And I believe beauty is a physical, real thing in the physical thing of the physics world, just like quarks or black holes or anything. I think beauty is something that is underpinning everything. And so for us, it's like to restore it into our hearts, so that in our relationships, in our adventure of our life, in our careers, in our traversal from cradle to grave, we have a sense of beauty throughout the whole thing. Even though we get sadness and brokenness and illness and all these kind of things, there's a sense of beauty that goes along with that. So I wanted to make that distinction, I think.
Yeah. So again, I want to ask you the question, how will you know and how will you see when beauty is being restored at an individual level, at a community level, at a kind of human species level?
Yeah, because that's a good question. Because is it a feeling? Do you feel something? You know, we know when we talk about Friesenism, where you have like goosebumps on your arm, or, you know, like goose flesh, they call it, right? Or something that a passage of music makes you shudder. You know, we talk, that's Friesenism, right? I have the domain Friesenism.com. You know, can I believe in this, right? Friesenism, or the idea of frisson, which is like the French phrase for goosebumps. Is it that? Does beauty have to manifest and we get this feeling of... No, I think that beauty is the conduit between us and the transcendent or the divine. And so when we read a passage in a book that makes us read it over and over three times, four times, or we hear a piece of music that makes us get goose flesh, goosebumps, or makes us tear up a bit, or we see the smile of the beloved, we talked about this before, right? The smile of the beloved, yeah, who adores you, who looks at you with eyes of pure candor and pure wonder and pure adoration. When we feel adoration, and anybody listening to this, you know, watching this YouTube video or listening to the podcast, there's an adoration that you can feel that makes you feel, it's not glorification, it's not like worship, but it's adoration. They adore you. And when you have that, you are now in conjunction, you are now in communion with the beautiful, with beauty. It's like when you see, if you go to the Louvre, I was in Florence in January and I went to the Uffizi Gallery, you know, and Caravaggio is represented there. Caravaggio with the light and dark, the chiaroscuro of his moods, and Botticelli, The Birth of Venus, and you know, Botticelli is there, and you look at this Botticelli and you think, there's something that was captured in that, or the Rite of Spring. There's something that's captured in that, that somehow captures the essence of beauty and can grabs it and holds it for a second, so we can contemplate it. And that's why people who go there, you know, like a Stendhal had the Stendhal effect. I think it's called the Stendhal effect. Stendhal in front of the Botticelli's paintings had this religious experience, this out-of-body experience when he's there contemplating it. And he wrote about this, and it's a visceral, real thing, because he came in communion with something that was transcendent, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we're starved for in this modern age. There's nothing transcendent in modern art. There's nothing transcendent in modern architecture. There's nothing transcendent in the way we communicate, in the way... When we sit around a campfire, Jordan, as you know, as we sit around a campfire as brothers or the Amorati, right? And we sit in communion, there, you can feel that there's a transcendent quality to it. It isn't just like small talk. It isn't just like talking about whatever. It's transcendent, that you could feel that you're part of something larger than you, part of a collective larger than you, and it's necessary and is missing from the heart of modern man and modern women. Yeah.
I keep coming back again and again with a sense of mission, like, okay, this is the view. This is what I see, and this is what I see is missing. I spent a lifetime wanting to understand this thing that is beauty, and this is the what happens, the consequences when people are living a life not aligned with beauty. I just, like, listening to you, I keep coming back to the mission sense of, like, okay, what is to be done with this? Because restoring beauty, it contains within it the imperative to restore somehow.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, on a sense of mission, I'll speak a little bit more in a minute about my own kind of inner workings about coming to a sense of mission around this, especially in these times. But I'd love to hear from you about a sense of mission, which is, it's very difficult, I think, to restore beauty in any classical way, because you risk either being this kind of conservative curmudgeon, which is like the millennials, you know, this Tinder TikTok generation. They don't know anything about true beauty, because I have been to the Uffizi and, you know, I'm steeped in Shakespeare. You quickly become this very outdated university professor who is exactly the kind of people that are being elbowed out by an establishment at the moment, that don't have a voice or a chance for their their lineage knowledge to go down into the next generation. So there's an incredible risk of that happening. And then on the other hand, there's the risk of a social engineering. Like if you push the manifesto of beauty too hard, you end up in this kind of social engineering environment where it's like, I don't have a lived experience of this, but I look at the images and I hear Adelia, my girlfriend, her stories about what it was like growing up in Russia with a Soviet legacy, where it's like beauty was highly seen. And so yeah. You'd have to be training for 14 hours a day to cut it as a ballet dancer to embody perfection, yeah. Which has a tremendous light side and an incredible dark side to it as well, where there's a social kind of almost engineered element of trying to reach a certain perfection. So if we not only have the belief in the philosophy of restoring beauty, but we're actively engaged in the work of restoring beauty because we would like to bring about a restoration. Like I would like to spend my days in things that are more inspiring. For sure. Like have an ever opening vista of things that I just enjoy and that bring me into that frisson. I would like to see a world with more objects in it, which evoking me an ever greater sense of frisson.
Right.
I can say that. Not like we're without, but I would love to see more. So how do we teach this or transmit this or create some kind of movement without falling into these bear traps of, because there's not so much beauty in a social engineering project.
Yeah, there's not so much beauty in marketing. You know what I mean? It's like trying to get the word out.
The social justice warrior case of like, hey, you're not seeing beauty over here. Rattle on the tin cans outside of the White House.
Yeah, with the placards, you know, like holding up our signs.
Save beauty, restore it now.
Restore beauty. Beauty matters. No.
We should go and do that actually as a prank. We could make a prank video.
Oh my goodness.
Rouse 1,000 people to go.
But that's a good point because the protestor type of energy is not, we're not protesting. We're not trying to rip something down that has been oppressive. Beauty's not oppressive. And if we talk about restoring beauty, we're trying to reclaim, it's reclaiming beauty into our consciousness, into our fabric of our lives. This is what it is. It's a simple, it's a quiet thing. It's not a protest. It's not a protest. Mm. It's not like a down with ugliness, our placard, you know? You might march on the street. God hates ugliness, you know, like this kind of stuff. It's not that.
Yeah.
It's turning our face again. We've turned our face away from beauty. And there's no question we have. That's why we have this political landscape that we have. That's why we have this, this fundamentalist extremism landscape that we have. That's why we have this terrorism landscape we have. It's why we have this left versus right, men versus women, political ideology versus political ideology. That's why we have it, because we've turned our face away from beauty.
Yeah.
And beauty is the restorative to all this. Beauty is the salve. Beauty is the incredible equalizer for all of these things. And if we could turn our face towards beauty, and I don't mean like it's all happy-go-lucky and life is great and, you know, there's no problems on earth, because a component of beauty is sadness and loss. You know, so I think this concept. I'm on the edge of the understanding of this, Jordan. But beauty to me, and I don't have it fully fleshed out. I don't understand it. But I really do believe that beauty is on the, is our saving grace. I don't know what that means. It's going to save us. Beauty will save us. Beauty will save society. Beauty will save relationships. Beauty will save our sense of salvation. Beauty will save us, you know, from cradle to grave, this sense of absurdism or existentialism or this humanistic view that we're the only thing in the universe and humans are the supreme because we're the thinkers and we're the ones, you know. So what we talked about at the very beginning of this video is like the idea that there's an intuitionist sense of mathematics, which is mathematics is unfolding as it goes, just like particles become real when we observe them, you know. And beauty, I think, is the component that it's underlying component that all are drawn to. So if you look at anybody who's religious in any sense of religion, Hinduism, Shintoism, Buddhism, Protestant, Catholic, Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, Islam, Muslim, you know, any of this kind of things, we all have different ideologies and antagonistic and books of reference and books of sacredness, you know, the Book of Mormon, the Book of the Bible, the Book of, you know, like the Quran, the Talmud. These are all sacred texts, right? We believe for ancient texts, we hang our hat on them. We bow down before them as like the supreme voice of something, okay? And yet, no matter what these differences all are, including the atheists who have a different text, who have a different religion that they worship, which is religion just like anything else, the atheists in all these religions all have a calling and a draw for beauty. So there's a concept in analytical logic, in logic, you know, Aristotle, Socratic logic sort of thing, which is Aristotle said, if Jordan is in Bali, then he cannot be outside of Bali. In other words, it's a positive, which is Jordan is in Bali, so Jordan is not somewhere else. Okay, so like there. And there's a concept called the law of the middle. The law, I can't remember what it is. The law of the impossible middle. There's no third way. You can't be in Bali and not in Bali. And there's no third way. You can't be in both at the same time, right? That's Aristotle talked. He talked about these in his concept. I forgot what I was going to say about that because it's interesting. But the idea is that beauty is underpinning, that is a real thing, that is magnificent, that is fortuitous, that is life-giving underneath all of it, the whole thing. I talked for a lot. I don't know what I said. But it's a fantastic subject. The subject blows my mind, you know? And maybe now we have the collective consciousness to try and contemplate and understand these things, because maybe we didn't before. I don't know.
Yeah. I had a quote or a lyric come to mind a couple of moments ago, the Jeff Buckley. It's not a victory march. It's a soft and it's a broken hallelujah. And it's almost like...
Yeah. Leonard Cohen wrote it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Leonard Cohen, Montreal, Canadian guy. Hello.
Yeah. Lots of Leonard Cohen fans are circling me at the moment.
What a poet that guy is, man. Leonard Cohen. He wrote, there's a great song. There's a great song, look it up, he just released. I think he just released it. It's called If You Want Darkness, We Kill the Flame. Look it up. It's a fantastic song, man. It's fantastic. Great. He's one of the poets of our age, for sure. If you want it darker, we kill the flame.
Yeah. So any work on beauty almost seems like it has to be, it has to cut through the mass noise with complete quietness and then quietly point people to something even more quiet still.
Yeah, you can see, Jordan, as I'm trying to articulate these things, I'm lost. I'm on the edge of my ability to articulate what I'm thinking, because I haven't thought it out yet, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like there's something that is beyond my grasp that I haven't touched yet, that I'm trying to fight for and trying to understand. And so I talk in platitudes, I talk in circles. But there's something very real underpinning our conversation that has not been touched yet. I really believe it. And I think this is the only conversation you could possibly have going forward for me. And I don't get it. I don't understand any of it. I don't understand physics. I don't understand mathematics. I don't understand Leonard Cohen's poetry. I don't understand any of it. I'm like a babe in the woods, you know? But I really want to know. I want to know. And I'm excited to sit until the day I die. I'm excited I'm only excited one thing. I'm not excited about Lamborghinis or yachts or hot babes in bikinis, you know? I'm not excited about anything at all except for sitting in this contemplative wonder and learning something new. And maybe I don't, but the potential is there. And I'm like, I want to be on the cutting edge of science and physics and mathematics and philosophy, you know? Incredible. That's me.
I want to weave... I want to bring a couple of threads into the conversation. One is a question we get asked a lot about, which is purpose. what does it mean, purpose? And what is it? How do I find my purpose? And what is it like to live a life on purpose? I want to include a lot of that in the next piece, because it's a perennial word that surrounds our work. Men are looking for a sense of purpose in this kind of disenchanted and fragmenting world. The other thing that I wanted to talk about with you today is the cycles of society or the cycles of culture. So I read a book.
Oh yeah,
The Fourth Turning.
Great book.
I came across it through a video on YouTube, and it's basically the author Neil Howe, one of the authors of The Fourth Turning. In 15 minutes, he says more in one YouTube video than I've heard in weeks and weeks and weeks of analysis of what's happening in world affairs. And in one 15-minute video on YouTube, it all clicked for me. A lot of things that I'd been suspecting and wondering and fearing and hoping for, like, all together. So first thing I did was download the book and read it within a day, The Fourth Turning. And then you had stumbled across this a few years prior as well.
I heard about it years ago, I read about it. But I didn't see the YouTube video you're talking about. I'd like to see it. So put a link to that. Give me a link.
It's so dense. He condenses the entire book basically into this one YouTube video.
It's an incredible concept.
For sure.
It's incredible. I discovered this probably 5-6 years ago, and I was shocked by it. And I thought it's going to be okay in this world because of that, because of what they said. And it makes sense to me. So I don't have this apocalyptic gloom and doom, you know, a destructive feeling or about a future of society. I don't. I have this. There's a fourth turning. This is going to turn around again. There's a recovery happening for sure.
Yeah. It brings me a lot of optimism and hope. It also brings me a lot of foreboding as well, because it's like, oh yeah, it's also, if it's built. So I'll give an introduction for the viewer who might never have heard of this, but basically, it feels like we're, as a society, unraveling and then dropping deeper and deeper into a crisis.
Yeah.
And we don't yet know what the crisis is. We thought it was COVID. Now there's Black Lives Matter and the protests and the conflict over that. And so much stuff is going down and down and down, like the whole humanity almost is winding down a plug hole. If you actually look further than the American narrative or the Western-led narrative, it can look even more atrocious. And I've been really up to date with what's going on in Venezuela lately,
right?
Which is this kind of economic collapse that people are fearing so much in the West has happened.
It's just devastated
the country, and it's Peter Zeihan, who's one leading geopolitical thinker and strategist, is talking about this is the end of Venezuela this year as we know it. It's like has to crumble because it's got nowhere else to fall apart from complete the government, you know, it's dying basically, and even hospitals have not got any medicine. They're just going there, but they've got no air conditioning and no running water.
Wow.
So yeah, like what can you do in that level of poverty? And just not poverty because it's a rich country, but just breakdown of the entire infrastructure, which ends up causing a human breakdown of lives, of well-being, of children being born malnourished, and then the mental ramifications of that as well. Child doesn't grow properly on all levels without so much food. And I'm like, I'm looking in horror, and it's this. So I'm studying, there's a word for this, collapsology.
Oh, never heard that.
Collapsology comes from a French philosopher whose name I forget, but it's a pretty new term. But it's
the
study of entire civilizational collapse.
Like the Romans, like the study of the demise of the Roman Empire.
Archetypal case study. Entire social, cultural, and infrastructural collapse. Hmm. And people are out there saying, what if this happens? And I think that's such a vital conversation to have. And then there's people that really buy into that narrative of like, we're facing a social collapse. And they see no end. And then there's another way of seeing things where it's like, yeah, there might be a total collapse. Like World War II was a total collapse of many regimes around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a new world order that comes into place and establishes a new system that countries and people can operate under. And then things flourish again. So by 1946, I heard in the US, they had their biggest bonanza year imaginable, because at the end of the war, and then they won. They established the new order and became the new superpower very clearly. Things took up. But then pretty soon after, in places like Japan, which was the absolute demolished arch enemy, things also started to take up in the 1950s. And then by the end of the 1980s, Japan is equaling the US in economic power.
Right.
So there's something about a lot of ideas I want to spit out. These four turnings, societies go through four different movements. You've got this like this silent but quiet reconstituting of an entire country, or culture,
or rejuvenation.
Which is a quiet kind of rebuilding process. But there's a hell of a lot of civic togetherness and values. Like we all value the same thing. There's not a lot of conflict. These are really the boom years. So that's like the late 40s, 1950s, and a lot of the 60s in Western countries. And then you get this awakening, which is at some point, the next generation comes along and looks at the last 20 years and says, well, hang on a minute, this is like really stuffy and stiff. And this doesn't,
I reject this.
Doesn't give me the freedom and the liberty that I need, because the new generation were the ones that grew up in a kind of, they didn't actually know the horrors of the war. So they grew up with stability and they want to reject it. And then you get the hippie movement, flower power, anti-Vietnam, you know, that was a very unpopular war.
Yeah.
Compared to the Second World War, where everyone's allied. So you get this awakening. And then by the end of the awakening, you've got everything has been broken down. So everything that was established that kind of won the war and gave rebirth to the society, the kind of the family unit, the sure kind of male, female, masculine, feminine roles in the family and society, all the different things that kind of prevailed in that moment reached this apex of like,
and then
questioning.
Yeah.
Deconstruction.
Yeah. Deconstruction.
And then you come through the kind of late 70s, 80s, and 90s, where it's unraveling and undwindling still. Men and women lose their kind of gender roles and other roles are kind of, politics is looked on with suspicion, and everyone's just out for themselves. Out for themselves by this point. There's no real sense of community yet left. Materialism and skepticism and jadedness, and a lot of the kind of 1920s Paris, the lost generation of that great generation of artists. That's the old Generation X.
Yeah.
So those writers in Paris are at your generation from 80 years prior that are living in the same world mood.
100 years ago.
Yeah. And then we slip out of this Gen X, like, what's the point? I'm just going to do what I want because no one really gives a shit about me anymore. Everyone's just in it for themselves from the top to the bottom. That unravels more. And we're in this nasty, nasty period of crisis.
Yeah.
And for me, I don't know if there will be a World War III. Like, there are some pretty ugly face-off-y things that are occurring. But there are certainly these wars between different tribes and people, these cultural wars at the moment, which are absolutely antithetical to beauty, like the rampant identity 100%. Politics and the chopping down of other people. We are in some kind of subtle world war of different tribes and different people, all trying to establish a sense of dominance, perhaps, but at the cost of everything else. So everything's getting hacked down. Whatever you believe in is being hacked down. And so I, watching this happen, and when the virus hit a few months ago, I'm thinking, wow, I'm part of this message about restoring beauty, but maybe that's a luxury I can't have anymore. Maybe
because
I need to
society?
Restore. I'm seriously had a few doubting days, wondering, has my journey to understand beauty and rapture and the transcendent and the esoteric mysteries and luxuries of relationships and the sublime in all kinds of forms, has that just been a product of these times, or a product of the privilege that I've grown up in? Is it necessary anymore? And I'm thinking, well, if society collapses, I don't need to restore beauty. I need to restore the electricity and the gas cylinders in my kitchen.
Well, you look back,
the rice in the pantry.
You look back, you know, Jordan, what you said, like with the fourth turnings, the generational turnings, you know, like we had World War I, like I'm talking about this century, right? We had the physics revolution with Einstein's event. Then we had World War I that destroyed a good chunk of the positivity in the world. Right, immediately following that, I had the Spanish flu, which was like in magnitude, orders of magnitude higher than what we have in the coronavirus. The Spanish flu, which just devastated, you know, the world. And then you have the Great Depression and the Dirty 30s. So there was no optimism. It was like, is the world ever going to recover? And it's all gone to seed and all terrible. And then you had World War II to cap that off, right?
Yeah.
And then you had, like you said, the
final demolition.
Yeah. Then in the West, you had the greatest generation after that who's going to build, and optimism and the nuclear family and the white picket fence and all this kind of stuff. And that was rejected by the generation after that, which is the, like you said, the free love generation, the hippie generation, which rejected the conservatism of their parents and the 50s Stepford Wives type of. And then you had the 80s consumer, 80s and 90s, which is rejecting the hippie free love, don't shave your armpits, you know, burn your bra spirit. And they said, no, we're consumers, we want to consume. And now we've got this, like you said, this energetic antagonism. So we've gone through different cycles, and they repeat, the cycles repeat. You go back 400 years and the cycles repeat, right? So is there an optimism in the air in the forthcoming generations? Like, if we have this real political anxiety and this destructive, destroying, you know, separation between ideologies, is the generation that's coming to fruition beyond that is going to say, no, we reject that. We reject that. Are they going to be conservative and restoration? Or are they going to be even more further progressive and tearing down institutions and tearing down, you know? And then the further question to that is, so when you said, is my desire to restore beauty, restore this the transcendent, the sacred, these qualities, is that misguided because there's some fundamental building blocks that have to be done first, you know?
Like we all have to descend down the Maslow's pyramid to take care of security and
then
so
you can
on
go back
we
to
can
the,
go back to our vantage point of chin stroking and hairs on end, you know, enjoyment of art.
Yeah,
that's what I wondered.
But yeah. You know, I think that, you know, I think that the breakdown we have and the breakdowns we've had in generations of the past, this pessimistic generation we've had, like they call it the generation after World War II was the greatest generation because they were optimistic. They could get a house, they could get a wife at their church, they could bang out three kids, they could, you know, they could and
shoot down the enemy and yeah. fighter jets, you
and,
know, like
and their kids are a bunch of whiners. Because I did it. I went to Auschwitz. I went to you look at the people who went to the concentration camps of that. They lived to be 100 yeah. years old. They lived to be 100 yeah. years old because they have this sense of, you know, that brokenness, that famine, that destruction, the typhoid they experienced didn't destroy them. They lived longer than any other generation, right? They live old. So those parents, as boomers, look at the younger generation and they're entitled and whining and crying. And come on, I went to a battle. I fought something hard. I had mold in my boots because I went through the trenches. And I still got a house and did this kind of stuff. And you're whining because, you know, you've given everything. So something, there's a turning. And I don't know what the next turning is, but I really yeah. do. I believe there's an optimistic turning happening, going to happen.
Well, so this is the most fascinating topic in the world for me at the moment, this idea of the fourth turning. And if you look back at all the historic turnings, and if you extrapolate this again, then there is a theoretical set of circumstances that will arise. And it's like history won't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. It will, with all the technology and the interlinked societies that we have around the world, it's going to look and pan out in a very different way, even though the fundamentals are supposed. And we'll see in a few yeah. years time, we can write to the authors of the book and say, you know what, guys, good theory, you know,
what are they
got
saying?
Your job for a
2030
few
is when it's going to be like a shift, right?
No, they initially said in their book, they wrote this in the early 90s, they said at the start of 2004 it would go into the fourth turning, which is utmost crisis. But they reviewed that and they say that the 2008 financial crisis was the start of the current crisis. So everything that's happened since that financial crisis, and they put sticking plasters over the economy so that it would go up for the last decade. It didn't really hit the rock bottom that it needed to regenerate. It's blown up into more bubbles. And then you've got everything that's happened over the last 10 years has just been an extension and a delaying of the crisis.
Yeah.
And now we're in 2020 and it's like it's hit. And I've heard the phrase, this is so goes back to the theory of like beauty and the horrific for me, because I grew up and I'd say to my friends at school, fuck, like my granddad's stories are amazing of when London was getting bombed and he was going out dancing six nights a week with all the women because the soldiers were off fighting and he had all the girls, and like his stories are amazing. And our generation is so crap, like nothing's happening. And it's almost like, okay, now stuff is really happening. Like we're yeah. actually living in a historically significant moment
yeah.
after two or three decades of relative ease and stability.
That's right.
And I've heard it said the 2020s is going to be the decade that you look back on in the future and everyone's going to be studying this in the history books.
Wow.
Like we're now kind of in the 1930 to the 1945 period in terms of breakdown, and who knows what the fuck is going to happen, but it's going to be gnarly and lots of people are going to be affected by it. So it's like this kind of
living in the era, you know?
Yeah, living in the era. Like great art is being made and will be about to be made now as a response to the crisis. So it's like I think the one beauty in the crisis is that we're all going to be stretched to be able to deal with what's going on. And so the more, if you believe in polarity, the more kind of war and ugliness is flowing and flourishing at the moment, there's a hell of a lot of ugliness flourishing, there has to be a corresponding entity, which is no matter how ugly it gets between people, there has to be movements that are restoring beauty that are going to come with more and more vigor.
Wow.
You're
absolutely right.
There's a counterbalance to this.
I haven't thought of it on that perspective, Jordan, but it's absolutely right. I mean, like if we're doing anything with Ars Amrata, if we have any draw, and the guys and the women that are drawn to the conversation we're having, And it says that resonates with something that, you know, that I intuited as a boy or as a girl. And I resonate with that. I haven't thought that perspective that you just said, that, you know, like there has to be, it has to exist because of a counterbalance. But even though I know that it has to exist as a counterbalance, it's a restoration. We're in a rest.
Yeah.
You know, there's an era in the English history which is called the Restoration. Mm. You know, it's kind of what it is now. It's a restoration. It's restoring something that is being destroyed and broken down on all sides.
And perhaps that's what we're doing. Like we're precursoring an era of restoration that might kick in a few years down the line, and that our children and grandchildren will then tear up, and, you know, to our dismay on our deathbeds to watch that then get deconstructed. But
wow.
So this gives me more urgency. So purpose is born from crisis. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to find purpose when there's nothing to apply oneself to in service of a better future. And so if what you see around you is crisis, it's very easy to get purposeful because there's stuff to solve. And so I feel a greater purpose, a greater urgency arising in me because I look around and it's like, wow, things are so exciting. Like, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows the next big collapse? Who knows what country's going to end up in famine? Who knows what political leader's going to come to power and actually do something destructive? Like, because almost like the ring of the Cold War is coming back through. Like, you know, is he going to say something, and are they going to do, and should get bombed for that? Like, at some point it will happen. Like, all that's in the air, that there's a pregnancy and a horror, but an urgency for this kind of purpose that I feel. So I didn't get a resolution. I was talking about feeling a sense of what is the role of beauty in all of this? In such an unraveling, like surely I should be doing, you know, mucking in and getting my hands dirty, rolling up the sleeves, and
I don't think
fighting
so,
for the country.
No, I don't think.
But it gets clearer and clearer that without beauty, there's nothing to fight for.
There's nothing to fight for. That's
so
the whole
point. Why would you engage in any kind of war? Like, say in the example that there are no women around, who would we defend? There's no women and children.
Would we look for? Who would we look for in this world? Who would you travel for? Why would you travel over here to look at what? You know? So yeah, Jordan, it's absolutely right. Like, it's like without beauty, there's nothing to stand on and nothing to restore. There's nothing to look forward to. There's no, you know, that feeling people have that I have nothing to look forward to. Nothing looking to look forward to right now. That's what we'd be missing, you know. It's like,
So I'm in love with this theory because it paints for me like a much more stark picture that we're going to pass through as a world, which has me galvanized with a sense of purpose, and really brings a sense of aliveness. But then there's hope on the other side as well, which is these kind of culture wars and what's going on in the media. Even the media at the moment is dying. It's hanging on.
Yeah.
Mainstream media, people have lost faith in politics. People have lost faith. Maybe politics as we know it won't exist anymore, mm-hmm. let alone these great big news broadcasting outlets. maybe it's all gone, like this decade.
Yeah, and then, you know, like, the only salvation we have is this concept that beauty will save us. You look at the beginning of democracy and the beginning of the dialectic, which is in ancient Greece, you know. Before that, what did they have? Warlords, maybe, you know, and conquering tribes and taking your women from other tribes. Not like, no courtship, no wooing, just like, I want that one and that one and that one. And I'll go destroy that tribe to take those women. And so, you know, we're not going to go back to that because we have this birth of democracy, this birth of the rule of law. Western democracy is built on this, you know. maybe it goes away. But I also think that, you know, we talked about earlier, this the intellectual potential of humankind is increasing. So we are much more potentiated in our intellectual knowledge or potential knowledge than someone 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. So we can conceptualize something like, a computer type of algorithm where if you explained that 1,000 years ago, they could never, with their worldview that they were raised on and the turnips they ate or whatever, I don't know, the genetics, they weren't intellectually ready to receive that. I don't know. So I really like this idea of the fourth turning, you know, the concept of the book, the fourth turning, and what they created, because there's a pattern throughout history where simplified, the generation that is extant rejects the values of the generation that was their parents. So the hippies rejected the conservative 50s, you know, and the 80s rejected the hippies, said no, we're consumers, you know.
Yeah.
And it was there's a collective optimism in the 80s and 90s that was rejected by the individualism today.
Yeah.
So that's going to be this Me Too generation, which is my rights, my thing, is going to be rejected by the generation following, and that are going to say, you gave us the societal ills, you gave us this ideological separation and division, you gave us enormous debt. You gave us, you know, world, you know, country debt. You gave us the inability to buy a home with a simple, you gave us, you know, you handed all this to us. You passed down to us, school debt in the West, you know, like student loans and stuff. You handed all this down to us. The generation is coming beyond that is going to say, we reject that. We're going to solve that because you didn't, and we're going to solve it.
Yeah.
And we're going to fix it.
Yeah. And they will have to.
And there'll be another can-do generation. They have to.
So the maths of it is, according to the theory of the fourth turning, is that the baby boomers who grew up in the best of times.
Yeah.
Materialistic, but self, inward focused, self-righteous, self-entitled,
motivated
in a lot of ways. They're going to have to pass into elderhood and realize that their retirement's not going to be as cushy as their growing up.
Right.
And they're going to have to actually find out what elderhood means as a way to serve the younger generations rather than serving themselves.
Yeah.
Gen X, which is like, okay, no one helped me when I was growing up, I'm going to figure it out myself, has to take the same pragmatic stance of going it alone in the world and turn back and being of service and of use to other people. So there's no more kind of like solo star entrepreneur people. It's like, no, we've got to do this for a collective thing. So their skills get turned back in a sense of service.
Yeah.
The elders bring the wisdom, the Gen X bring the service, the millennials right now who are, that's the next greatest generation, the next can do. So what the millennials will do is they're the ones that are going to muck in and actually do the effort to save everybody.
You think the millennials are the ones after the millennials, like the generation after millennials?
Yeah, the millennials. The millennials are the ones that will ultimately do that work, like the grunt work.
Yeah, because we can't rely on you anymore, ancestors. So we're going to fix society and do this kind of, and it'd be more of a positive.
A lot of the millennials, because of their upbringing, have been very sweet until now, but at some point they're going to turn around and say, hey, you Gen Xers and you boomers, like, you created a fucking mess. And if we're going to get out of this, like, you need to stop being so individualistic. And a lot of the millennials have grown with a real deep, sense of community and, conformity. Mm-hmm. And so actually, like, the Gen X is much more individualist. The dress and the lifestyles and what they choose for themselves is very, very diverse. But actually, millennials, they're coming through a lot more like each other. Mm. And I think when that generation meets its challenge that it has to meet, it should coalesce into hey, let's cooperate, and we won't have so much hierarchy, but we'll have a bit if it's needed. Like, let's go. And I don't need more of the pie than you, because I want you to feel heard and seen and respected as well. There's, like, underlying a lot of this identity politics is a lot of goodness as well. Like,
that's arising. I want
to see the people that have been oppressed and suppressed, and I want to see that their innate human qualities actually come through and find its place in the tapestry. So we'll work together quite nicely as a team and ensure that everybody has their part to play. So there's a real heartfelt, empathetic beauty that generation has, that the older generation is just. Young guys are great at empathy, and old guys are like, it takes some work.
That's funny. It's true.
To bring that skill set online. And then the young guys have got less ability of like self-determination and boundaries and just like, I'm just going to speak my mind to hell with what you think. Hmm. And that's a thing that is in deficit right now. But it's interesting, I think, because they're going to create, and I'm spouting fourth turning theory.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the fuck's going to happen. But the idea is that the millennials are going to create the new real socially stable structure where there is a code of ethics that everyone can band around behind and say, this is a good thing. And we all cohere around this one cultural narrative, and we're going to fight for this one cause. And the cause could be anything from, you know, Russia, if it was in the Cold War era, or the Axis powers, if it was in the last, or it might be climate change or some other country. But they're going to cohere around this one thing, and they're going to build a lot of stuff. So when old institutions fall, who's going to design the next media? It's going to be based on this Spotify versus YouTube versus Apple Music and so on. And it's the millennials that are going to have the imagination to build those institutions and make them as good as possible to solve the problems that we have. They're going to be in control, and they're going to be the people. So if you look back, and this is the slightly scary thing, if you're not quite a millennial, if you're a little bit older and more individualistic, with the greatest generation was incredibly conformist. And the reason you had the hippie, the 60s uprisings is because they were fighting conformity.
Yeah.
And so to even get through a level of international crisis, I think there needs to be a certain level of conformity where you sacrifice your individualism for the collective.
For the duty, responsibility. Yeah.
And if you look at the retiring, this generation is like, really, it's just a few left of this, but the ones that survived World War II, they're all like unique characters, but they're all the same. Like, they wear the same clothes, they go to the same gala dinners, they eat the same food. It's like they dance the same waltz and foxtrot. It's like that there's different characters, but the cultural
conformity.
Hegemony, is insane. So it's like, are we going to have a new era of like, okay, this is in. You're allowed to say and do these things, and this is out. Like, if you're a kind of hairy, unshaven Gen Xer who is like rattling off conspiracy theories and doesn't want to muck in with the public effort, you're kind of out. And I wonder if people will get kind of culturally ousted if a new very conformist but collectivistic group comes through.
Have they updated their book, The Fourth Turning? Because I have it on my Kindle. I had it for years.
I heard from the author the other day, one of the authors the other day. I think he's working on something new in the next year or two, because it's all happening now.
Yeah.
Like his fourth turning prediction, we're on the cusp.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So he's got a lot to say. Neil Howe.
Yeah. And so are you optimistic, and, or is he optimistic?
Yeah. I think he's optimistic. I'm super optimistic.
Me too, but actually. I'm very optimistic.
Optimistic in two ways. Like, we discussed this before. I'm optimistic in the sense that like there will be a fourth turning. It's like, no matter how bad the pain in labor or the screaming as the baby gets squeezed out, it's like, you know.
Just, yeah, no matter what.
Fucking kill me. Like,
it will recover. Like,
as much as you're getting ripped apart in the process, I do believe that I do believe in the power of the cycle. This is the historical perspective that history is cyclical. It's cyclical. It's not linear. That there is going to be a radically new and fruitful solution. So I'm bullish for that, and I'm bullish for the ingenuity of new generations, for sure.
Yeah, me too.
And I grew up, you know, like maybe it's not the same in all parts of the world, but even though England, my country, was decimated in the war, the people feel like they had a united victory. Like the people, we won this war because the people.
Yeah,
banded
it was a very collective optimism and jubilation. It was jubilee, you know, and celebration in the air for years.
Yeah.
It's a very strange in America too.
So that's I feel that at least in the national fabric that's inside of me.
Yeah.
So it's like what humans can band together in incredible ways. Like bring along a good crisis, everyone will put down the iPhone and go and meet the thing walking down the street, and we'll see like if there are some parts of the world that are actually so fractured they're just like, you know, screw it, just take us. we'll see. But in the meantime, the opportunity, and this is my practice, is to look into the eye of the storm, like the beauty and horror, to link it back to the top of the show. The beauty and horror piece is no matter how bad things get, then that's an opportunity to meditate on and go right into the heart of. And it's the same advice that we give to people in a heartbreak. Or in a rejection. Mm-hmm. So you fell in love and she said no. and now you've got to lick your wounds, but the wounds are really deep because you put everything in. You put everything into this love and it didn't work out. And so you can try and fix it on a bunch of levels or distract yourself and try and work around it. But the only way to heal that is to be like, okay, heartbreak, take me, like, let me feel the full thing. I'm not going to anesthetize myself or drink myself into oblivion, but like, let's take on the full grief and the heartbreak and the pain of the lost thing. And in that grief, it's if you go deep enough into grief, beyond the tears and the real somatic, like the felt feelings that the body is getting ripped open and you just want it to end. Like if you can just go bravely enough into the eye of that storm, you get the healing. So the out of the deepest pain comes it's another portal. Pain as well as beauty, I believe, is another portal to that transcendence. Wow. I digested my grief and my pain so fully that I come out the other side in beauty. And that's where we get great works of literature are always tinged with this horror. Like you never get a great work of literature that was just rosy all the way through.
No, you need
there
conflict.
Has to be the immense high with the immense low, and it's only after you tackle those pages and those chapters of immense tension and unraveling and low and plunging into the heart of disaster, then you can get the salvation. So there's the other reason I feel bullish is because I'm like, you know, throw at me hardship and difficulty and so on, and even though I don't want it, I don't want to lose all the beautiful things I have in my relationship. No, like I'm quite happy with the status quo, but if it were to come, I would be horrified and in denial and make it go away. But there's still a part of me that's like, okay, let's actually face reality here. Because in the midst of that devastation will come something sublime.
Yeah.
Anyone who's known a heartbreak deeply knows what I'm talking about here. And it's like, crisis is a collective heartbreak or something like that.
Yeah, you'll know what you're made of. You'll come out of it. Yeah. I'm very optimistic too. Throughout any kind of hardships or sorrow or unexpected calamity, which happens, right? Circumstances happen. I really have this sense that at least we're trying. At least we're trying to understand something. I really have a sense of it. So I'm very optimistic. I'm optimistic for the future generations, like you said. I am. I'm optimistic for what we're trying to understand and trying to talk about and create. I'm not pessimistic at all. You know, even though the world is a pessimistic worldview, you know, the Weltschmerz, you know, Weltschmerz of is like is a there's a very dour view of the world, you know, and you know, I don't have it at all. I really think in, I believe in beauty. I believe that beauty will save us, and I believe if we contemplate beauty, the Bible says, whatsoever things are beautiful, think on these things. Think on these things, not these other things. So I don't gravitate toward society's ills, and I don't gravitate towards politics and, you know, and the movements and the protests and even the coronavirus is a time of contemplation and a time of reevaluation. And it's nothing new. We think, oh, we're so burdened by this virus has hit the earth. No, there's been the bubonic plague and the Black Death and the Spanish flu and you know, even in 1960s, I think, or 50s, there was a massive flu that went and destroyed a part of the population. And we think we're unique, we're snowflakes, we're like, oh, like I'm so hard done by because I've got this, I have to wear a mask and I have to, you know, like I have to like social distance. It's been like that. Imagine social distancing in the bubonic plague times. We had the,
when,
you know,
when like, you lived 11 people in a one bedroom house.
Yeah. And you had to have like this long mask of part superstition and part, you know, sage, you know, and breathing fumes and stuff like that. Try not to get it. And they didn't have germ theory then. So they had no concept that they thought it was like mystical and you're going to get it or you're not going to get it. And no such thing as so imagine social distancing and wearing masks in that era. Mm. Where it was unknown and you get it by chance as opposed to, so yeah. But we're so hard done by, and we're so oppressed by this, you know, and we complain and say we're the unique generation that has to go through this hardship. No, you're not. Not at all.
Yeah. Everyone has to go through the hardship.
Yeah.
Like no one misses it. And the kind of the very ironic beauty of the fourth turning is that just as we approach a crisis, everyone that prevailed in a crisis has now died.
That's true. So you have no collective memory of it, right?
There's no knowledge. Yeah.
So you have to scramble.
Yeah. So you will, and certain people are born at different points in the cycle, right? So you're either going to get your crisis when you're in your first 10 years of life or in your last 10 years of life, but you won't ever really get two, and you probably won't get away with having none. So we all get to see the same cycle of events, just at different moments in our lives.
Incredible.
Yeah.
With different
viewpoints. It makes me so excited. And I think from our perspective, I've been, of course, following a lot of self-development and men's work for 10, 15 years. And we've got a hell of a number of followers who I think are biding their time.
Oh.
And the Emirati and the closer circles of people that I know, I feel like they're biding their time. Because these are not men that are stuck in the culture wars. They're not people that are firing off against the feminists and trying to prove anyone wrong and themselves right.
They're not trying to fight.
And they're not collapsed in apathy either.
Yeah, they're like, not giving up.
They're not men that are just sat on the bed watching Netflix. Well, everyone has their day off, I guess, in a month. But they're not men that are ruining the world. They're men that are quietly, perhaps not able to put their words upon what's going on exactly, but they're using their time to prepare themselves in their own way, their own physical, spiritual, intellectual, professional pursuits. And I think now's come in the time where it's like, okay, the need for your purpose, like these men are like, you setting your speeches, like living like champions is one of your core themes, right? To live like champions, the world needs us to show up.
Yeah.
And then we're sat in the back of the seminar room. To what? Like, where can I show up around here? You know, to the shops, to the bars? Like, what's that? I can show up and be a consumer. That's like the limit of my perception of what I could potentially do in service of the world. But now I think we're coming to a place of culmination where the sheer crapness of everything that's going on is an invitation for you to bring something great and to go into that struggle to express something. Express what it is that you know and what you see and fight back, I think, for beauty.
Yeah, fantastic, man. I'm the same. I'm blank right now, Jordan, because I think you said it. You've captured it. I'm sitting listening to you because you've captured the essence of this. And I think that you really have your thumb on it. You know, like I really think that whatever you're exploring, certainly in your research and reading the concept of the fourth turning, I really believe in this cyclic nature. You know, there's a reason that there was the Jubilee year, the year of the Jubilee, every 50 years in the Old Testament, you know, because that's a recycle that comes back around again, and everything's forgiven on the 50th year, and you go back again, all debts are forgiven, everything, you know? Yeah. Those type of cycles have always gone around, and it's an optimistic human positive type of energy, the feeling of that. So I'm same with you, and I'm listening to you because you research it more than I have. That's why I'm not commenting too much, but you have your finger on something that is essential for the conversation going forward, for all the people listening to this, I think, this YouTube or this podcast, whoever's listening to this and they're drawn into this, there's a great, we talked about motivation on our last episode, if you remember, and my call out to the audience was, if you have any concept of motivation, any books or texts or concepts that you've discovered that would illuminate us, me and Jordan, in this pursuit of understanding, send it to us. And same with this, you know, like, if I want to know who else is, because we're not alone, and there's collectives, you know, and the collective and conscious, and, you know, Jung talked about ideas being born at the same time all over the earth. So who else is talking about these things? I want to know, I would like to find them. I'd like to seek them out. We should seek out the authors of the fourth turning and
bring them on.
Bring them on. Absolutely.
We'd love to.
But find those guys.
I was in my room stroke office the other day with the whiteboards and the big sheets of paper and the pens, you know, as I like to do when I've got enough time on my hands to go crazy on the bedroom walls. There's an incredible beauty and deep inspiration for me in this conflict of two themes. So we've got this collapsology, the sense of everything is unraveling and spiraling down into an ever deepening crisis. But then we've got the concept of transcendence. So we've got incendence, the slow diminishing and destruction of everything, while at the same time there's a force of transcendence, which is aspiring and moving up.
And
I'm seeing like that there's something about this 2020s where we're having these two movements at the same time.
Wow.
And just to think of that, like, obliterates me, like my mind, in that, to see and feel those two different dances, and the amount of close friends and colleagues that we've got that are supremely interested in rapture. How can I meditate and experience it? How can I travel and ayahuasca and with women and the lovemaking and see the beauty? How can I penetrate into the spirit of beauty more and more and more? And yet the world is crumbling down in many ways.
Downward spiral is happening. And at the same time, the conversions or the meeting of these two upward and downward moving energies. And we're right at the cusp. We're right at this point of, you know, where it's meeting, you know, and I feel that too, because we can no longer look at this downward spiral. We can no longer, like, everybody's contemplating and looking at that and like in agony and worry and wringing their hands and, you know, and scraping their sores with pottery shards, you know, and lamentations. Instead, we've got to catch the upward draft, this upward flowing energy, and hitch our wagon onto that, connect onto that, as opposed to this downward, which goes down a downward spiral into destruction and despair, and catches upward flow. Yeah, completely.
But I think without losing touch of that downward spiral, because we can cut ourselves off and go to some mountain cave or some ashram and just go on the
become
the
spiritual, transcending
and forget and turn a blind eye to the whole situation that all of us are in the world. And so these two forces have got to have a contact with each other. And I'm like, my kind of war cry is everyone that's listening to this and fascinated by these themes and interesting is like the sense of purpose and having something thrilling to do and the opportunity to emerge into the, I don't know, the public sphere and have a gift to offer that is going to make you feel that's going to make you feel like a war hero from 1945 at the end of your days. And you're going to sit around in the old ballroom and like nod and wave what did you do? And oh, I was in reporting in Venezuela when the thing fell and the new people came from the bottom. There's an opportunity for all of us, I think, to find what is transcendent in us, find which is exquisitely beautiful, which is always exquisitely beautiful, even though everything is unraveling and dwindling. And in these two movements, the best art, the best journalism, the best novels and new forms are going to be created out of such a fusion. It's a
we're
very
born out of the
time.
convergence of this upward moving optimistic full force of creative energy and this downward destructive societal thing. Yeah, I agree. The conversion of it.
And the best apps and the best code and the best coaching
Everything.
You'll ever do, like, and the best nursing and medicine, like whatever. Don't want to limit this to art, but whatever is your vocation, it's like now you've got the ultimate creative constraints. Like, I mean, it's it's full on.
So a new era is being born.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, Jordan. Incredible.
Yeah.
Let's wrap it up. I think that was a good point. I have a lot to think about, you know, like this, the last half of this call maybe really, I'm mentally taking notes and I have to do some research and I have to sit in contemplation. It's fantastic. We're on the edge of understanding something and I don't know what it is yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're lucky to be alive right now.
Yeah.
There's never been more opportunities. It's very precarious and scary. And if we make it through to the other side, our conferences and our talks and all of our gatherings for the rest of our days could be tinged with real aliveness.
Yeah, no question. Fantastic, man.
So we'll see.
See what's going to be born of this energetic movement.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Excellent.
So thanks, Zan. Thanks for watching.
Yeah, I'm blown away, man. I'm like vibrating.
What all right. What is there anything at the moment that stands out to you as a main kind of takeaway or a number one thing that's caught you?
Well, for me it's the societal concept of the cyclic transitioning and to new generations of that. And I don't quite understand it. And I want to understand it. Like, and I do believe it. I believe it's real. It's been real since the Roman, you know, since the Romans and the Greeks. It's real. And I talk, you know, yeah. No, I just, I'm sitting in a lot of theoretical questions right now. Before this call and during this call, and I don't really, I can't articulate or can't put words on it. I printed out the first 20, 30 pages of the book I'm writing, right? And I'm looking at it in book form. I'm like looking at it and I'm thinking this is good, but it's missing some qualitative ingredient. It's some spices missing to it. I don't know what it is. So I'm really sitting in a sense of contemplation, Jordan. Our episodes of the Zan and Jordan show are fantastic to me because it's on the cutting edge of what we're trying to understand. The things you're talking about here that you introduced to me I'm like, huh? It completely makes sense. And I've contemplated these things before, but not on that level, not on the level of real pure immersion. And I feel like I just want to absorb and absorb and absorb, and I want to learn more, and I want to collate it and put it into a book form and write something down. And I don't know. I'm just completely, like I said, a babe in the woods. I feel completely like a novice. I'm a novice in these kind of concepts. That's what I feel. And I'm so, yeah. And there's been giants that spoke before us on these themes all the way back, you know? And we're trying to articulate it in our small voices, in our small uneducated ways, you know? Like, we're trying to say things that have been said well formed and well constructed and well articulated before us, but it doesn't diminish that we're trying and that we love it. And anybody who's listening to this, who joins Yom Marathi or becomes part of our tribe, is the tribe that I'm part of. I'm part of that tribe too. I'm not some leader or some guru figure. I'm part of a tribe too. I want to be sitting in communion with guys and women who have the same conversation at the tip of their tongues, and they can't articulate it, on the tip of their hearts. They really want to know these kind of things. So,
yeah,
I'm excited for that, for the future of the contemplative conversation. Yeah. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I'm humming too, like a caged tiger. I don't think there's any way we can get off the island, marooned in paradise. But I'm hungry to come back towards civilization and to be in a room of like minds. We lost our conference because of the lockdown. To be in a group of 100 or so people.
Yeah, like, I'm hungry for it too.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Send us a message if you have a comment. Comment below. Subscribe, whatever format you're getting this podcast through. Like, hit the subscribe button. We'll be back approximately every two or three weeks.
Something like
episode. And we'll talk about something else important.
And as you can all tell, we just kind of drift. Like, our conversation drifts, and we just wander over here and wander over there. But it's what I want. I want to sit in that because it makes me. It builds urgency in my heart. It builds a sense of real pointed and directed contemplation, as opposed to daydreaming, looking out the window, and you know. So if you're listening to this and this really resonates with you, send us a message, and send us your thoughts on the concepts that we have tried to scrape at. We're scraping at it.
Yeah, and if you've got more updated philosophical tools than either of us, then please help and pitch in and
or
give
links
us some critique
to something.
And move us forward a little bit.
Yeah,
here.
help us.
Quotes are always useful.
Exactly. Okay, Jordan.
All right.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks for watching, everyone, and we'll see you soon.
Adios.